I would just say there's one misperception of our veterans, and that is they are somehow damaged goods. Although if we tell our veterans enough that this is what's wrong with them, they may actually start believing it.
Hey, this is Tommy from Recon Rings, and you're listening to Dead Reckoning Radio. Use code DEADRECKONING to save 10% off any purchase at reconrings.com. Recon Rings, for those that live kinetic lives.
Hey, Doug, how's it going, man?
Good, man. How are you?
Good. Doug's on the show tonight. Doug K. Sweeter, or however the hell you pronounce that 27-letter name.
It is safe to say that when your name is German camouflage for he's a Jew, you can pronounce it however you'd like.
Doug is the director of... What was it at Softly?
Director of content and the number one gun bunny.
That's
at
it.
Softly.
That's it.
Yeah.
So
I'm a sexual object that gets paid well to run around in jean shorts.
Well, I was just going to ask you to kind of tell everybody a little bit about yourself, but we'll we can leave it there.
No,
then.
I mean, I think to be more serious, I essentially manage a stable of influencers and content producers, so. I am generally kind of directing or editing or formatting, you know, a variety of articles from 30 plus authors, you know, any given week. And then also working with our creative content, like videographers and photographers to establish like kind of unified marketing themes to promote products or to kind of, you know, push forward the Die Living ethos. So it's actually a super fun job. I told people for years that as a special forces guy, the thing that kept me coming back was that I didn't know what I was going to do every morning. Like I wake up and who knows what the fuck I'm going to do, right? Mm-hmm. And at Softly, I came on really early. I was actually, I think, our first full-time paid employee, and I am not sure anyone knew what my title was for probably 2 years. Brent told me I could pick whatever title I wanted, and I was like, the vice president of executive outreach business relations. Like, it was some ridiculous title. I didn't know. I was, like, trying to be humble and span all the work that I did, so I'm like... don't really know. And eventually my job took a lot more shape, and it started with me doing a lot of writing. And then, you know, as we started to expand our network and meet more talented authors, it became a lot more about kind of managing other authors and writing more limited content, but kind of overseeing other stuff.
Hmm. So
it's a fun job, man. It's a super cool job.
I guess we can, and you're still in the guard as well, right?
Yeah, I am actually a Special Forces Weapons Sergeant in Bravo Company, 1st Battalion, 20th Special Forces Group. Shout out to the boys in Albemarle. It is a group of the most talented and broad spectrum hitters that you will ever meet in your entire life.
Beautiful.
Lovers, fighters, all of them.
Which one are you?
A little bit of both, and I'm not good at either.
Gentle with both. So I mean, I guess we can back up a little bit, and then we'll jump. We're gonna get heavy into Softly and what what all you're doing there, and expand on everything that you just talked about. But we'll kind of go into your background. You know, your upbringing. You're a Texas boy.
So, yeah, man.
Let's start there.
So my dad's been in the oil business for a lot of years. He's actually in the solar industry now, but we did the New Orleans to Houston move when the oil industry shifted. I went to high school in Houston. When I graduated, I ended up going to Texas A&M University. I failed out my junior year because fuck school. I wanted to do cool stuff and school sucked. Yep. And I knew what was best for me, right? And I ended up throwing pipe in West Texas and being a roustabout. Or as my Mexican friends called me, a wasano, which is a worm, like basically the lowest of the low. And I learned a lot there, man. I learned a lot about like perseverance, and you know, the pay was good, especially for somebody who dropped out of college at $25 an hour, 80 plus hours a week. You know, I was bringing in comparable cash to my friends that had graduated, you know, magna cum laude and were doing like real jobs. They're like, where do you get all that money? I'm like, bro, it's just, it's cash and it's under the table and it's fast. And, you know, slinging sucker rods made me pretty strong and I got a good tan. And when I would drive the 7 hours to Dallas on the weekends that I randomly would get, girls expressed some interest in me. So I stuck with it for a while. But
something was working.
Yeah, I got tired of explaining to people why I dropped out of college. And, Or was kicked out, I should say, because my grade sucked, right?
Yeah.
So I went back to night school. I cut back on my hours. I got reaccepted to A&M. I graduated. I was class of 2002 originally. I graduated in 2004. And I thought with a degree, I'll get a cool job that pays way better. And I went and I worked for a geological firm in Houston. And the pay was terrible. It was awful, man. It was like, I'm doing this job, and I thought this would be super cool, and all it was depressing that I'm barely getting by. So I ditched my lease, and I got in my truck, and I drove back to Midland, and I got a job working in the oil field again. And, you know, the pay was twice as good, and I enjoyed myself, you know, people I understood. But it's a heavy drinking culture, and you're with a lot of rough dudes. And while I really liked that, I kept thinking to myself, like, I can't do this shit at 60. Like, I got to there's no progression here. Yep. I mean, I was working with guys that were in their 50s and they were dying of cirrhosis from drinking too much or just, you know, I mean, fuck, man. Everybody looked like Clint Eastwood from The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. It's like,
yeah,
too much sun, too much sun, too much sun. After a 3 p.m. beer in Jal, New Mexico. And by beer, I mean like probably half a case. Yep. And then driving an hour and a half back to Midland and sitting on my couch drinking about a half a fifth of whiskey one night. I was watching a show on the Discovery Channel about the Green Berets in Afghanistan. And this was like, this is like 2000, this is 2004. It was right after I graduated, really.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, fuck this, man. I could do that job. And, like pretty legitimately, I mean, I was a fucking idiot. I was really full of myself kid. I think I was like 23 and, I started doing some research, ended up joining the National Guard through 20th group. I actually joined in Mississippi because it was the closest unit at the time. There wasn't a special forces unit in Texas yet. And, you know, many trials and tribulations later, I got a Green Beret, went to Afghanistan a few times, went to Iraq a few times. And I guess, long story short, here I am. In the process of being a guard special forces guy, you kind of have to fill the gaps in with work, right? So I started a few small businesses that were kind of successful. I started a company called the Duke's House, which was born of necessity with my best friend of 20 years, another special forces guy.
Yeah.
He actually works with me at Softleet right now. He's a fucking genius and I hate to suck his dick, but he really is. He's pretty awesome. Like, we are best friends and it's more like we're married. Like both of our wives are generally like off put by how much we bicker and yet are still best friends.
You guys are so cute.
Oh, dude, it's ridiculous. And people, they're like, oh, man, I thought you guys were just joking. I'm like, nah, man, I'm an idiot. Also a genius, and I love him. So we started a boarding house for special forces guys that are on long-term temporary duty orders at Fort Bragg. and that has been successful. I moonlit for GoRuck in between deployments, which was kind of like, I don't know, leading leadership events all over the U.S., kind of encouraging people to push their limits and discover what it is like to be in charge in a high-stress situation.
Yeah.
That was fun. I did that for 4 years, on and off. I did a million things. I'm pretty sure my wife has hives from all the times I've, you know, been like, hey, this is a cool thing. You know,
jumped into a new endeavor. Yeah, you got a lot going on.
Money's good, right? And in the end, like, you have to be willing to do some really, like, you have to do some scut work if you want to pay the bills. Yeah. And, like, 2014, I realized that my family was falling apart because I was just gone all the time. So I came back to the States, and I caddied at Pinehurst for two seasons. Just like, hey, man, I was committed. I'm not gonna leave the country. I'm staying here. I'm gonna, you know, do the family thing. And I actually made almost as good money looping at Pinehurst as a caddy as I did contracting in Africa. Yeah, man, I made $450 a day off the grass in Pinehurst. And, you know, you'd be surprised how popular a Green Beret caddy is.
Oh, that's true, huh?
Yeah,
just a token.
It's all about telling stories, right? So, like, you show up and, like, you're like, yeah, man, hey, my name's Doug. I'll be your caddy. Also, I'm a Green Beret. And you're like, no, you're not. I'm like, yeah, man, here, check out some pictures. Here I am, you know, in Afghanistan. Here I am in Iraq. And dude's like, have you ever killed anybody? And you're like, yeah, man. Like, what kind of question is that? Like,
sure.
Do you fuck your mistress? And the guy's like, oh, my God. I'm like, man, I was like, I hope you golf better and you fucking make conversation, you know, which now the power balance is back in the caddy's favor. And, you know, it was a good time. I actually got the job. I had not golfed since I was like 14 years old. And my interview, the woman who was interviewing me was like, well, like, do you play golf? And I was like, nope. I mean, I had nope. I was 14. And she's like, well, why do you think you'd be a good caddy? And I was like, well, as a Green Beret and a SODA qualified guy, as a sniper, I can tell you where a bullet's going to go at 1,000 meters. I'm pretty sure I can tell some putts who's four beers deep where a golf ball is going to go at 70 yards.
And I think Google translates those skills for you now.
Yeah, she started laughing. She's like, well, you have the job. And I'm like, thank you.
Thank you, man.
Yeah, man. So I met my partners. I met the guy, like, Softly guys. Like, I met Brent and Aaron through GoRuck.
Mm-hmm.
And Brent started Softly with Aaron in, I'm trying to think, probably – I mean, it would have had to have been 2015.
I'm trying to think of when those PDFs. Actually, you know what? I'll just look at my email.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure 2015 is the beginning. And Brent hit me up and was like, hey, man, come help me start this company. And I think that Brent thought that I was much
January
more
2015.
Well- yeah, there you go. See? Yeah. I think
that's crazy.
I've always been very in touch with what I do not know, but that doesn't mean I want to advertise it. It also doesn't mean that I want to take a job that highlights what I don't know. So Brent was like, hey, man, come start this thing with me. I'm like, man, I was already doing like four things at that point. I started a nonprofit that was doing like community engagement. I had the bed and breakfast thing going on. At that point, you know, I was just kind of like, kind of figuring the family out. I'm back. I just started a gym with a local friend, and it was like, mm-hmm. man, I am doing too much shit.
Oh yeah, I forgot about the gym.
Yeah. Well, it's one of these deals where you're like, I don't have enough time in the day for that. And I was trying to learn how to say no. So I told Brent, no. I was so proud of myself. And you fast forward like 10 months and Brent offered to double my salary from the gym and things were going crazy. Like the partnership of the gym was not as it had been advertised. Things just didn't go very well. And rather than like sour the relationship more, I was like, you know what, man, like money's not everything. I'm going to step back before I get angry and like try to burn the whole place to the ground.
Yeah.
And so I took a job at Softly, and I don't think we really knew what we were going to do at that point. Like, we knew that PDFs weren't a business. So we were selling PDF files, much like Rob Shaw used to do.
Yeah.
Where it's like, hey, here's a program to get selected.
Yeah, because you came on when it was still just the three PDFs, right? It was Juggernaut.
No, I came on when we had made the transition to Train Heroic.
Okay.
And one of the requirements to work at the company was to write programming.
Yeah.
So, like, I wrote two cycles. I wrote Rat Rod and, Lazarus.
Fuck off.
Yep. And, Lazarus sucks.
So much rowing.
Yeah, and on purpose, that program was written as a combination between it was the CAG selection prep program and a Olympic rowing team prep program. So like, the goals were to build, like, it was like, I haven't looked in a while, but I'm pretty sure it was like posterior chain development, and you're supposed to increase your lactic threshold or your alactic threshold. Like, I can't remember.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of rowing intervals.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, the thing is, I love the fact that that program came together, and because of periodization, guys were like, man, I want to get better at running. And you're like, hey man, just do Lazarus. And they're like, no, I want to do running. I'm like, yeah, do Lazarus. It will build all the energy systems that are important for you running.
Yeah.
Without running. Like, it's going to be low impact. You're going to do 12. Well, that was when we first started to look into like 14 week cycles too, where we did a test week, 12 weeks of programming, and then a follow on, like an ending test week. So we were experimenting with a lot. George came on as a full-time coach pretty soon after that. We expanded. I mean, in the 2 years from the time I came on until the time I left to go to Iraq, we went from like one employee to six. And then while I was in Iraq, we went from like six employees to like 13 employees.
Yeah, they were big. They were big jumps. I remember kind of seeing it from where I was sitting, and it seemed like you guys were growing like very fast, like in leaps and bounds, you know?
I mean, we got an, I have an assistant now that says something, you know what I mean? Like, she's better than I am. And we joke that she, like, literally she will replace Brian and I within the year. Brian jokes, I'm much more certain that it's going to happen.
Afraid.
I have yet to give her a task that she does not master immediately and do better than I do. I'm like, hey, do this thing for me. And she's like, yeah, sure. And I'm like, okay. And then I expect to have to go back and check and QC what she did. And I'll go looking for it, and I'll be like, oh, it's already done. And then I'll look through it, and I'll be like, it's like, good. All right. And I'll just call her and be like, hey, thanks for doing that thing that I barely asked you to do. Well, you know, while I was there, I collated everything, and I also like wrote a couple extra articles and contacted some of these people on Instagram to see if they wanted to work for us.
And here's your coffee.
Yeah. No, she's awesome. She's really good. She's crazy. Now learning. She's an understudy to Brian. She is learning all about like how to do film stuff. So like all the movement videos that you're seeing, and the coaching tips from Chris Van Brink, those are all filmed by Raven. She is,
which you can see awesome. The progress with you guys as well. Like from what originally was the,
what you mean cell phone videos aren't cool.
like the videos that were posted in the team room to eliminate stupid questions.
Bro, I die because I think about, so our marketing guy, Jeff, is one of Aaron's, so Aaron's our COO,
yep.
And Jeff is one of his childhood friends. And when I came onto the company, it was like, hey man, I'm a full-time guy. Like I almost feel like I was like that pity fuck. You know, like where you like you hang out with this really fat chick all through high school. She's super nice, and you can tell she likes you. And at a certain point, you've had like three beers, and you're like, well, you know what you got to do, cowboy. That was me at Softly. Brent and Aaron were like, well, we like Doug. And like things are weird for him. Like, we should bring him on. So like Aaron and I would hang out at his house. And we would like brainstorm content ideas. And I'm like, well, I'll write this article. Yeah, that's a good idea. Also, Aaron would be like, let's do a video for like, you know, for the pre-workout. All right, cool. What do you got in mind? Well, like, we'll just sit around and fuck off and it'll be cool. So we're filming all this stuff on iPhones. Well, the whole thing is I'm sitting there going like, well, you can't just like rest your phone against the TV and hit timer record. Like, let's get, you know, he's like, oh, dude, don't worry. I'll call my buddy Jeff. Well, Jeff was like, I'm pretty sure Jeff was living in the house in Aaron's guest house at the time. And so like Jeff comes in and Jeff's this like cool, unassuming dude. And we haven't brainstormed what this video looks like at all. And like, it all starts out with us sitting on the couch and being like, what do you want to do? I don't know. What do you want to do? I don't know. It's like, well, you know, let's get bent and do some dry fire drills. I'm like, cool, man. So Aaron mixes me up like pre-workout. It's like everywhere. And then he gives me this pre-workout and I drink it. And then we spontaneously cut to a scene of me with like a gun belt on, dry firing naked in Aaron's bedroom, which was a very funny video.
Yeah.
Made funnier by the fact that Jeff, who had never met me before, who is our now marketing guru, filmed like 8 takes from the front, like full frontal nudity, me standing there with a gun belt on doing dry, like draw and dry fire. And Jeff's just like, no, that take wasn't very good. Like the lighting was wrong. Let's do that again. And I'm like, you are using an iPhone to film all of me. And then like we randomly filmed one take from the rear and Jeff's like, no, that's perfect. It's it. Which was the take we used. But while all this filming's going on, Lisa, Aaron's wife, comes home. And Aaron's like, oh, hey, man, I should probably go tell Lisa that there's a naked dude in our bedroom. And I'm like, yeah, you should do that. This is the company that we used to have. And yeah. Now, you know, now we have all these employees and we have to change in a changing room. And yeah, I know. Well, you know, I mean, I realize that how things used to be might have been slightly inappropriate. I'm like, so, Jeff, would you like to be our marketing guy? It's going to involve you videotaping another dude's pecker in your boss's bedroom. That's not how you sell a job.
Things don't change.
No. I mean, they do when you grow up and you realize that, like, you have to mature.
Slightly.
Yeah. So it's we still have a lot of fun. I think that our idea of what content looks like has kind of developed for a long time. We made fun content that we thought would be cool, and like we also realized that that content oftentimes fell on deaf ears. And like the purpose of content is to promote products, right?
Yep.
Like, what's your message? What's your company's values? What are you trying to promote?
Yeah.
And I think that we've gotten a lot better over the years at like sitting down and asking ourselves what a valuable investment of time is. Like, hey, we want to make this video. Is there merit? And like a lot of the time, if the answer is yes, then we do a fun video. You know, the 2020 flannel video is that was a funny video. We had a good time. We did it in a day and we edited it. Like we filmed it in the morning. We edited it in the afternoon. There were like 5 outtake videos that went with it. We sold out of flannel shirts before the final outtake videos posted. And I was so desperate to post all the funny outtakes that like I was still posting them. And Brent was like, why are you posting those videos? We don't even have any flannel shirts to sell anymore. I'm like, but they're funny, man. Yeah. Like we filmed them. They got to go
up.
We'll
sell something.
Yeah.
I think that's the one thing that a lot of people, and I definitely have always appreciated about you guys, and I'll be the first to admit, like, a lot of our network at Dead Reckoning Collective has come from the Softly team room. Guaranteed.
Well, dude,
It's because it's a good group of people. It's a good, you know, like you guys bring a good network. You know, each of you comes from different backgrounds, and with that, you know, those people bring good people, and it's, you know, it's a collective of like-minded individuals, and that's,
it's a growing process though, isn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely is.
You've been around since day one.
Yeah.
And if you recall, and I think this is a talking point that is worth having. I believe that universally across the board, everybody at Softfleet is pretty progressive. And we've always been pretty progressive.
Yeah.
But we're also cavemen.
Yep.
Like, we cling to dinosaur shit. And I think that when the team room started and there were like 100 people in the Softfleet team room, there was like a lot of experimentation, and we spent a lot of time just doing whatever, because there's 100 people, who gives a fuck, right? Like, we shit talk each other. We're like, it's some of the epic piss fights between like Tyler Gibson and Nick Kiyama. I can't pronounce your fucking last name. Like,
me neither.
That probably, shit.
You actually probably have the same last name. I don't know.
He's Asian, but basically the same. So like these things were funny, right? And Brent, in an effort to get people to promote like quality shit, like, nobody wants to be part of a message board group where people don't post like fun shit. It's like, hey, I have like a bunch of technical questions I want answered, and then nothing cool attached.
Yeah.
So Brent posted this whole thing. It was like, hey, if you're going to ask a question, it needs to come with a tax. And the tax is you doing something cool, or a cool gun, or a cool car, or a hot chick.
Yeah.
It with 100 people in the team room,
got real
that
bad.
Shit was like, well, but you know, like, we don't want to tell people how to live their lives. Like, I don't want to fucking have to be a goddamn senior NCO in a fucking in the team room. Like, we did it, and it was joking and fun, and I banned a bunch of people for no fucking reason, just because, you know, Jericho and I would lose our fucking minds. But we're fucking banned that guy, right? But, like, as the taxes got out of hand, like, dudes started posting pictures of, like, their significant others or their girlfriends or their ex-girlfriends in, like, various states of undress. And, like, I was spending half of my working day deleting inappropriate shit that I was like, hey, man, this is a fucking violation of consent. This is fucking,
yeah,
like,
this goes beyond just the rules that are posted in the About Me section of the group. Like,
exactly. This is sexual exploitation. Like, you guys are engaging in, like, borderline revenge porn on our fucking forum. And, like, I'm spending a lot of time, like, scrubbing
it. Yeah, is it too late to take back what I said about the like-minded individuals?
Well, no, it's funny because I feel like we were like-minded individuals, right? Like, I mean, in general, until there was a growing pain. And like,
and then there was the purge.
I think that Brent and Aaron and I were all very uncomfortable with the direction things were going, but we didn't necessarily know how to be adults about it. And we were all conflicted about like who was going to pull the trigger.
Yeah.
And eventually we very heavily restructured what taxes looked like. I mean, I think the big indication to us that something was really wrong was that the time that I spent moderating the team room was spent equal parts. 50% was deleting inappropriate posts, and the other 50% was blocking wives, significant others, and females from joining the team room. Because I knew that the things that got posted as taxes were so offensive that, like, there were certain people that didn't belong there, right? Yeah. Like, I just didn't want to fucking deal with it.
Man, the last thing you want to do is have a COO of a company be brought in for divorce court. Like, it's just not, well, it's not a good look.
I literally, like, at that point when we were talking about it, I was like, hey, does this strike anybody else as fucked up? Like, that I won't approve a female to come into this room because things are so inappropriate. And it was really, like, I think that the wake up that happened before the Marines United thing, but when the Marines United thing happened, I was like, holy shit, I know how that group became what it was.
I feel like they coincided too, because I feel like it was it was definitely referenced.
I definitely threw up the new rules in line with Marines United. And I was like, hey, we're not there, but we're on our way. Like, yeah. You guys are starting to post things that if the person you were posting pictures of was here, would feel violated. Yeah. And that is not cool. Therefore, like, we restructured what taxes look like. We still insist on taxes, man. But, yep. Like, the taxes are, like, you doing something motivational, your kids.
Which, you know, is funny because I always used to feel weird about posting things like that, right? But, like,
yeah.
I'm a fucking grown-up, and, like, I'm a married dude who, like, I don't have a stash on my phone that I could just peruse through to fucking post in a Facebook group. It got to the point where, like, I would throw something up there, like, I'd have, like, a little section in my phone just for that, like, when I would actually have a legitimate question to ask, which was...
That's why I make my wife dress up like Sailor Moon. Like, here's a tax.
You're fucking ass.
But I ask for permission first because I am a gentleman.
Amen. HR. But yeah, man.
I think it changed the climate of that group. I think that there was a small group of people who were genuinely pissed. Like, how dare you tell me that I can't post pictures of my ex-girlfriend's titties in your group? And I'm like, how do you think that it is appropriate to post pictures of your ex-girlfriend's titties in a group where a bunch of people can see them? Like, you know what, man? We were better off without you. Yeah. And like, I don't miss those dudes.
No. I've heard a lot of people call a lot of different people sellouts, and I think you guys were just going the higher road.
Well, I hate the higher road because I feel like the high road is a cop-out. Like, people say, oh, I took the high road. I'm like, shut up, you fucking idiot. Like,
yeah.
There is no such thing. Like, you saying you took the high road is you copping out of the hard choice. And, like, for us, like, we didn't take the high road. We confronted guys. We got down in the mud. We got dirty, and I was like, fuck you, you're the one who's wrong. Like, we didn't take a high road. We were just like, hey, man, like, we were never about this. And we looked the other way because we were uncomfortable with confronting people. But in the end, like that's not what we're about.
No, like, if you guys, look at a business plan, that's nowhere in it, right?
But you know what's funny? I think that we say that as a business plan a lot, right? Like, well, it's not good for business. Fuck that, man. Like, I don't care if it's good for business or not. Like, I'm not about the objectification of other people for business. Like, dude, and it sells, right? Like, I can polarize our company. We can attire ourselves to political beliefs or ideologies, and we will sell more product. But that's not what we're about. We sell a good product. We sell workout plans that work, and we sell kind of an aspirational – Brent gets super mad. Like, we're not a lifestyle company. Yeah, but people typically want to live a certain kind of life, right? Like, you see what SF guys do, what Raiders do, what we do. It's awfully. And you're like, man, I would really like to do that. And there's nothing wrong with that. And we spend a lot of time talking through how we got where we are, the decisions, good and bad, that got us here. Maybe ways to get here faster or, faster than we did. And I mean, I think that resonates. I think that we did ourselves a really good turn by refocusing on die living as the driving ethos of what we do. Like, I think it really refocused.
So for anybody that's not familiar, do you want to just kind of give the die living spiel and explain that?
I think that – so I will digress for a moment. I think that early on and I think in a lot of other fitness companies, especially soft-oriented fitness companies, the temptation is to tell people that they have to meet a bunch of prerequisite barriers. Like, if you want to be considered fit enough to be on this program, you need to have done – A, B, and C to this standard. Mm-hmm. And I think that we felt that way early on. We're like, hey, we want to attract the best athletes we can attract. And you know what? We're going to start holding people to a series of, like, these are the gold standards of performance for us.
Yeah.
And I think that was foolish, man. I think that we felt like we could find people that could maintain all of these metrics. And I think that what all high performance fitness places find pretty quickly is in any broad spectrum, high level standard of physical performance. Even top athletes can only meet those standards in a very narrow window.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, you might want a guy to do, like, a sub-7-minute a sub-7-minute 2K on a rower, and then also deadlift 600 pounds. You know?
Okay.
Some people are going to be able to do those close together. Some people are not.
Yeah.
But, like, the reality is that most guys will be able to do a six, like they can do a 500 or 600 pound deadlift. Like they can do a max deadlift and a max bench press and probably a max vertical jump and a couple other things. They can meet very high standards in those at the same time, but they probably aren't going to hit their PR on running a marathon in conjunction with their max deadlift.
Right.
And I mean, maybe, I mean, the goal for us is to, we want to flatten the line between those things as much as possible. So we're training generalists. We want guys to be as good as possible at all the important tasks in their life, fully knowing that maybe that means that they're performing below maximal in all those things.
Mm-hmm.
Because for a tactical athlete, which we originally, our focus is a tactical athlete. When we talk about it from a mission statement as a company, we say that our focus is a tactical athlete. To loop this back into the die living thing, I think that the generalist, the tactical athlete, is every human who doesn't know when they're going to have to perform, but wants to perform at their maximum capacity in an unknown window.
Mm.
So, like, if you're a Green Beret or a Ranger or a SEAL, you don't know when game day is.
Right.
I can't name a date that is the time I want to peak for. Like, I don't have to get my Kern score, or I don't have to get my Wilt score to a certain point for the Kern Open, right? But I do know that at any given point in a 9-month window or a 6-month window or a 3-month window, I may be asked to perform at the highest level I can possibly perform for an unknown period of time.
Mm.
I don't think that is any different than any other human being that enters a gym. Like, we go to the gym to train to be good at life. I think a small portion of people go to the gym for aesthetics. They want to just look good. They like being in the gym. But I think that most of us, like, want to be faster, want to be stronger, because we want to be better at playing with our kids. We want to be better at running a triathlon, or, you know, like, we're tired of being beaten by some real asshole in a fucking pickup game of basketball in the neighborhood. Like, it's like, I want to perform at a higher level because I want to do something better. I want to climb mountains. I want to hike the Appalachian Trail. I want to ride a mountain bike. You know what I mean? Fitness plays into all those things. And there are not programs out there to train people to do those things. I mean, generally there are, but they're not periodized, they're not focused, and they're not really geared towards longevity. It's like, hey, I'm going to teach you how to be the best possible at this thing, and, like, I'm a professional football player. Dude, what do you know? Like, you don't have any training in how to train. We only know that you're a monster because you're genetic and you're an anomaly, you're an outlier.
Yeah.
I can't train like you train and expect to see the same results. But I want to look like you, and I want to perform like you, so I'm going to listen to what you have to say, and then inevitably I'm going to be disappointed.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of rolled back the physical training aspect, and we're like, yo, like, we want to die living. I want to, like, have you ever seen the movie Secondhand Lions?
Yes.
Fucking great movie, right? Yeah,
Robert Duvall, like, right?
Yeah, it's a kids movie. It is a straight-up kids movie, but Robert Duvall and what's the British guy's name? Michael Caine.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're like, you know, we want to go out with our boots on. You know, like, they flew their biplane upside down through a barn. And, you know, like, the thing they said is, like, those guys went out with their boots on. Like, yeah, it was ridiculous, but they were old and they felt like they were out of – they'd done everything, and so they tried something new and it didn't work out. But they died doing something they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And I think that so often people set targets for themselves. Like, I want to do this thing and it's a ridiculous thing and I don't know how I'm going to get there. There's no roadmap. And they spend most of their time wishing they were doing that thing, but not really doing anything to get there.
Yeah.
So for us, like, our motivation is to keep people pushing their boundaries in small increments. Like, you know, I mean, there's a million inappropriate analogies I can make to that.
Yes.
But, yes. Like, I mean, like, we don't need to find a hard limit mm-hmm. where you're like, holy fuck, I hated that and I don't want to do it again. We should be just constantly pushing the edges, seeing what our capabilities are. And when we get to some place and we're like, wow, that, like, this is comfortable, like, we can push a little further out, you know? Yeah. I mean,
like, not everyone has to be, you know, in a glider suit or
proximity wingsuiting is not for everyone.
No. I think that
the marathon is a really good example, right? Like, I mean, how many fucking soulless, unathletic motherfuckers do you know that are like, well, I like to run marathons? Well, you don't win marathons. Like, you just walk a marathon, motherfuckers.
You just go.
Yeah, like I get it, man. You got into this marathon and, like, you finished it in like 5 hours. Like,
you get that sticker. And...
I'm not sure that's an accomplishment. I mean, it is. Like, kudos to them for doing something that puts them outside of their comfort zone. But
yeah,
a lot of those people are in a comfort zone, right? Like,
yeah,
they know what 26.2 miles on a flat surface feels like. They spend a lot of time doing long, slow distance to do that marathon. Me personally, like, I think that if Ironman triathlons are a really good example where it's like, man, you have to be above mediocre in all three things, running, swimming, and biking, to be able to place well and not die.
Yeah.
On an Ironman, I think that, like, running a triathlon or riding, like, 100 mile, well, insert any length bicycle thing, anything over a mile, open water swim. Like, these are all, like, hard things, but they're all things that you can kind of do training sports specifically. I think that the idea that, you know, hey, man, like, I want to climb the Grand Teton or I want to hit 5 14ers in, you know, 5 days. Like, I want to run a 100 mile race, like, you know, the Moab, what is it, 240? Like,
right.
All of these ridiculous races, like, you don't really know what's coming. You're not training for that. Like, you're trying to build an energy system for an unknown challenge. And the challenge is you versus yourself. It's not like you versus nature per se. I mean, it is, but really, like, nature will not prevail against a resolute and prepared individual.
Yeah, willpower.
Yeah, but you don't know what's coming. Like, you're like, man, yep. I'm going to do this 100-mile race. I'm not actually running that fast. I'm walking a lot of it. Also, like, how much elevation change is there? What does this mean for me when I'm like, you know what, man? Like, I've had enough. I think I'm just going to chill out. You know, like, or maybe you almost die because, like, you're not adequately hydrating and you're not having the right nutrition. And you're like, you know, man, like, I'm going to push through. And you have a buddy that's like, hey, you look terrible. I think that those things, like, not to denigrate a marathon, but I think that those unknown challenges are more meaningful to us as individuals than a known distance, like, performance metric.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Like, I don't think that it is. If I decide that I want to get a sub-7-minute 2,000-meter row on a rower and I focus on training for that single task for a month, I will get there.
Mm.
You know, I mean, it's just going to happen. Like, you know, hey, I want to run a sub-6-minute mile. Yeah, man, I'll make that happen in 30 days or less. A known metric performance standard is pretty easy for us to hit. It's like when people are like, I'm going to lose this weight, and they lose that weight, and then they're like kind of lost or like, what's next? I think that it means a lot more to adopt a meaningful program, like a training program, to build an attribute a performance attribute, and then apply that to something that like is really unknown. Like go hang out with strangers, do a long race, do a, just go out and explore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think that's what you guys bring to the table that other, you know, whether it's targets that come like, or sorry, companies that target the tactical athlete, or companies that just go after, you know, the average civilian that wants to lose weight or get better at this or get better at that. You know, that's what you guys have really expanded upon, is there's a little bit of something for everyone and every goal, right?
Yep.
Like you guys still have the mountain program.
It's called Backcountry now.
Yeah.
But, it was Mountain Hunter to begin with.
And which is pretty specific, but
yeah, and it
can also be kind of diverse. Towards,
it's prepping for the livable backcountry season. So yeah. Like if you started it, yeah, it's a lead up. It's peaking you for hunting season legitimately, yeah. But we re-geared it for kind of backcountry athletes. So right. Hunters, hikers, et cetera, they're all trained there.
Yeah. I mean, from that to quick or basic, yep. You know,
which, I mean, those all develop from necessity. Right.
Yeah. And I mean, customer feedback too, right? Like,
well, I think that we've typically, we've assumed that when you're dealing with a tactical athlete, you're dealing with a guy who has an indefinite period of time to work out. Like yep. His job is geared around physical fitness. So you're looking at like, hey man, like it's not too much to think that a guy has 90 to 120 minutes to work out every day. When you start talking about people with regular 9-to-5s, that's a really huge allocation of time.
Yeah.
So like quick is still a comprehensive periodized program, but it's been streamlined into like 60 minutes.
Yeah. And which is awesome.
I did Juggernaut on the last deployment and I saw a lot of really good gains from it. And I jumped into Phoenix after that as a kind of a rehabilitative stamina cycle. And I think I was like 4 weeks in, and it was, or maybe 6 weeks. It was really grinding me. And I was just really, I mean, I had tons of time to do it. I just was demoralized. And I switched to quick, and I saw bigger gains on quick than I had seen on Juggernaut, just because I needed to change a pace. I needed a shorter workout plan. I needed to bump up my intensity and not just dread being there grinding for 2 hours a day, you know, where I'm like, man, more accessory work? Like, fuck this.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So, I mean, there's obviously, like we're talking about, there's something for everyone, and I think that's something that attracts others as well, where it's not just targeting, you know, you guys aren't just selling t-shirts that the military dudes are going to love. You're marketing a brand that is going to kind of join those circles together.
Well, the branding is undeniably strong, right?
Yeah, I mean, it is.
And it's also like very limited. It's funny, as we get bigger, we expand like our target market, the more we're like, we spend more time explaining what our special operations connections look like than we do explaining the product we're actually selling. And it's funny because I'm like, it's really irrelevant at this point, right? Like the product is good. It stands on its own 2 feet and the brand is super cool. But like in the end, like the people who keep coming back for the programming, they believe in what we sell. We started this program by selling a low output cardio strength biased program. You know, like, hey, man, like most guys want to get stronger, and being stronger is probably the most important thing you can do as a human. Like there's nothing in life that there's nothing you can't do better being stronger.
Yeah.
Now, that doesn't mean you need to be bulkier. It doesn't mean to be, you know, bigger. Being stronger pound for pound is an advantage. And yeah. We introduced programs where you could maintain your stamina and build strength and also work on your stamina and maintain strength. So we showed guys like, hey man, you can get faster while still lifting all the weights you want to lift, getting stronger and getting bigger. And it was simple, man. It's strength biased program.
Yep, absolutely.
It's not crazy. And I think that some people think that we've gone off the rails because, you know, we have stamina, like we have more stamina oriented programs. We have, you know, programs geared towards triathletes, programs geared towards backcountry athletes. We have a competitive fitness program for CrossFitters. We have teams for a variety of different athletic interests. We have a basic team. It's still 90 minutes, but it focuses almost entirely on movement. So like if you have been out of the gym for a while, you know, it gets you kind of back on track.
For the dad bods.
It's funny. I don't think it's a dad bod thing.
It's not. It is good programming. It is. It's not, it's like weird. Let's get you back out there, Tiger. Like
it does a lot of movements that everybody fucking hates, man. Like, guess what? I work out all the fucking time. And when I do basic, I'm like, oh my God, it's my least favorite fucking movements. Which highlights that I need to do more of them. Because if you're not good at them, then it's highlighting, you know, weaknesses in your stability. Like if you can't do something unilaterally, like one sided, you shouldn't be doing it two sided. You know, I mean, we tell guys all the time, you know, like, well, you know, everybody knows how to walk. Well, do they? Because like you make up for so many imbalances in your body because you do it on two sides. Like, you know, your body just contorts to make up for an imbalance. Like, I spent a lot of time driving a car. My right leg is stronger than my left leg just because I'm engaging in hypertrophic training every day. Brake, gas, brake, gas, brake, gas. I sit on my wallet. I don't take it out. I carry a pistol. You know what I mean? Like, there's a million reasons why my body sits in, like, it just kinked up.
Yeah.
And when you start to do one-sided movements, like what's featured in Basic or Phoenix, it really highlights the fact that you have asymmetry in your chain. And everybody needs to work through that to avoid injury.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's a lot of good stuff that we put out there. We can get nerdy really fast.
I think we've already gotten super nerdy. But hey-o. But we can get, you know, you can talk nerdy to me all night. I think that's what's always attracted me to the company, though, is the willingness to grow. Because there's so many that aren't, right? There's so many that will just stick to their market. And you guys have done a great job in not only sticking to that market and catering to the, you know, the OGs, but also expanding and you know, wanting to increase that reach. Because you guys have a positive message and a positive business model and a positive, like a good product that's going to benefit other people.
My opinion, and you know, everybody is like an asshole, right? We all have one.
Yep.
I personally think that the thing that has kept us going and growing is that we are all very in touch with our own failings. And a lot of people, I don't think that people are out of touch with their failings necessarily. I think that a lot of the time people know what's wrong with them and they go to great lengths to hide that, right? And at Softly, one thing that I'm really proud to say is that, like, we are all, like, we're all kind of fucked up.
Yeah.
But, like, we know it. And we took out a billboard to advertise our failings and we put it out on the interstate. And if, you know, like, I'm constantly amazed that more people don't talk trash about our failings. Like, hey man, I'm kind of a piece of shit sometimes, but I don't think that I'm an exception. I think that, like, all of us, like, have our shortcomings. And as Brent says, man, you put it out on Front Street, it's a lot harder to feel bad about it, right?
Yeah.
So, like, we're really happy to be like, yo, man, we know this, or we think we do. And also, I'm not that good at these things, but, like, I attract people that are. So, like, if there's a weakness that we have, like, we'll find a way to fill that gap.
Yeah.
And I think that being honest about our weaknesses helps us to identify a better team. Like, we build a better team. And also, like, we're not embarrassed. Like, I think a lot of guys are trying to hide something.
Yeah.
We've tried to partner with quite a few dudes along the way who have a lot of baggage. And I mean, I guess the jury is out on whether they're bad people or not. It's not my job to say if somebody's a bad person or not. But, like, in the end, they're trying to hide things from the world that are just, like, constantly going to come back and bite them in the ass, right?
Well, I think, and, you know, on that, like, even in, like, the Facebook group, there are so many posts, and I know I've commented on at least one or two of them where a guy'll, you know, he'll have a question. You know, ultimately, I hope, if there's a post, there's a question, and it's not just something stupid that he's stating. But he'll have a question, and he'll start it with, like, oh, you know, I did 5 years in the Army. I wasn't a cool guy. I didn't do this. And I've definitely commented on it at least 2-3 times where, you know, why are you leading with that? Who cares?
Starting with negative self-talk, like, isn't necessarily the right way to be.
Yeah, man. I mean, nobody's interested in the woe is me. Like,
well, I mean, I think that it helps. I think that guys feel like if they frame – I honestly appreciate guys who frame their service in a self-deprecating light more than guys that are, like, going to tell you how badass they were during their service, you know?
Transparency is great, but I mean, you know, be proud of where you come from and whatever you did, whatever that is.
Yeah. I mean, dude, I worked with a lot of fucking pretty badass motherfuckers and, like, people, I don't even know how to put this. The only person that I know who I've physically seen earn a Valor Award was a mechanic. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I think that the bare minimum expectation for people in my job is to behave in a valorous fashion. And I've seen some support people really perform above and beyond the expectation for what people thought they should do. And, like, those dudes definitely earned the Valor Awards that they received. But, like, you know, if I get a fucking pat on the back, like, that's more than I was expecting for my job.
Yeah.
And that's cool, man. Like, it doesn't bother me. I don't begrudge guys down talking their stuff. I do think that it's important in the process that guys have a good understanding of where they fit in the system, right? I think that everybody performs better if you're like, hey, man, like as an 18 Charlie, when I did the engineering bit, like, the temptation is always for engineers to be like, man, I'm all about demo. And I'm like, well, that's 5% of your fucking job, supply guy. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you own all the property books. Don't fuck them up. Make sure all the 1750s are right. And don't get anything lost in the fucking airplane. And Charlie's fucking hate that shit. They're like, oh, I fucking hate property. Why, man? That's like 90% of your job. Like, I don't know why you would self-select and talk negatively about something that you have to do every goddamn day. And, like, when I hear cooks say things like, man, oh, you know, I was a cook, but I fucking didn't like it. Well, man, that's sad. You did 4 years of service, and, like, if I was a cook, I would either get a different job, or I'd be the best motherfucking cook that the Army has ever fucking seen.
Yeah, man.
Like, I would learn how to turn UGRAs into a goddamn fucking Anthony Bourdain culinary delight. You know, and guys are like, well, that's not why I joined the Army, man. But then you should have joined the Army with a different fucking job.
Yeah. or at least acknowledge, you know, what you liked about the job, what you learned about the job. You know, I was an MP and I hated it. There were a lot of parts that I didn't like. I think it was a big mix of the bureaucracy mixed with the fact that I probably should have taken an infantry contract.
Because, I did not know you were an MP.
Yeah, man.
This interview is over.
This is done. Yeah, it's and it was one of those things. And but you know what? The positive is that I probably learned more about community policing as an MP who related better to infantry dudes than I could have in any FTO process.
Because that's probably true.
As an MP on an airborne post the size of, you know, Caserma Ederle, which is tiny, if you can actually immerse yourself in that community and you know, police that community and earn the respect of those guys, then how, you know, you could do anything. I mean, that's a catch-up popsicle. So... And I mean, I did it at Fort Lewis too, but like that was the big takeaway that I had is that, you know, whether I go into law enforcement in the civilian sector or not, that's going to be something I can take away. And if you can't take something away from your service, then you're lost. That's a whole bunch of time. Even if you only pulled a 3-year active duty contract, that's a lot of time. That's a lot of your life. That's just gone, and there's nothing good coming from it. You haven't found anything good.
When you talk to people about their service, I'm constantly amazed when people are like, "Yeah, man, like I should probably roll that back." I feel like different people take different things away. I think that you're saying some really wise things. I think that it is really interesting when you think specifically about young Marines, because the Marine Corps abuses their service members. So, like, they use guys up. You sign up for a 4-year contract, and we are going to get every ounce out of you, right? And, I mean, guys notice that. It's not like anybody doesn't feel it. And so, you know, you get a lot. And the Marine Corps seems to be probably the highest incidence of dudes who sign up for one tour and are out. They're like, "Yeah, that was good. I'm not coming back to be abused again."
Yeah.
And those are also the guys that are like, "Yeah, man, I was in the military. Thank me for my service." And you're like, "Well, dude, if it was a one-way transaction for 4 years, like if you gave and gave and gave and took for 4 years." Like, I understand why you're butthurt. That's not an arrangement that is sustainable.
Yeah.
But I do think that if your attitude is positive, like if you're like, "Hey man, like I want to get what I can get out of this. I want to learn. I want to enrich myself. I want to make me a better person." You get more out of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that probably applies to everything we do. Like, there's a lot of things we do in life that are fucking, that feel one way. Your marriage, your job, your relationship with your kids. You're like, "Man, I give and give and give, and these people don't appreciate it." And, like, what am I getting? Well, if you feel that way, you're never going to get shit.
Yeah.
But if you are like, "Hey, man, this is a two-way street. Like, I'm giving, and they're giving, and we're both taking something, too, right?" Like, I think that there's a lot more room for growth. And I think it's also, I mean, I think that it allows you to have a lot more honest discourse about whether you continue the kind of service that you're doing or if you pursue something different. So it's like getting out at the end of an enlistment is fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that, especially if you're like, you have a clear objective. You're like, "I want to go back to college and I want to pursue a different career." And like, I feel like I will be more satisfied and useful in this other vein. But if you get out and you're like, "Hey, man, fuck this last 4 years of my life. It was a waste of my fucking time. I hate everybody that I fucking had to deal with. And, like, this was prison."
Yeah.
Like, you will not carry good lessons with you moving forward.
Yeah, I agree. I think the way that a lot of people look at that is definitely not the kinds of things that we were talking about.
No, I mean, but you know, the funny thing
is, I think we're definitely in the minority.
I tell guys all the time, like, guys are like, well, if I could be SF, all right, man. So then you are. Well, if I could be CAG, yeah, all right, man. Well, now you are, right? Like, guys, guys always think that climbing a ladder is going to result in a greater happiness factor.
Yeah.
And, like, as a dude who spent a significant portion of my time in SF wondering if I should go try out to be in the unit, like, at a certain point, I matured enough to feel like I had a reasonable chance to try out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I realized that I didn't want to do that. Like, the thing that I enjoyed doing was being a special forces guy. Like, I was much better equipped to be kind of a community activist than I was to be a professional direct action guy. And it's, Worth Parker.
Yep.
Who is
a wonderful human being.
Oh my God. And it pains me to give credit to an officer. I don't want to, like, I hate to say that Worth is a wonderful human being because he is, but he is an officer. Worth told me a long time ago, you know, hey man, I was on a hamster wheel where I was surrounded by hard hitting special operators who were doing what I thought I wanted to do career wise, which is, you know, basically murder for hire is the wrong word. Worth wouldn't have said that, but no. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, hey, he's an officer. I wanted to be the kind of dude who put warheads on foreheads, like engaging directly with the enemies of the United States government was my number one priority.
Mm.
And then Worth is like, but that's really not what makes me happy or what I'm good at. What makes me happy is writing and like reflecting and mentoring other people into a greater sense of awareness. And, you know, like, I spent years pursuing something that I thought would make me happy, and I never felt relaxed or enjoyed myself doing it. And then when I started to do the things that I had minimized, that there were things that made me happy, but I didn't realize it, I suddenly felt a sense of satisfaction I'd never felt before. You know, like, I don't think that anybody in the special operations community is like, well, I really like to write.
Yeah.
And Worth was like, man, I love to write. And when I started
Navy
writing,
SEALs love to write.
No, they don't. They like to hire someone who can write to tell their lies.
That's the same thing.
For them. Stop. I can't believe I just, like, I'm going to get angry calls from my, like, three SEAL friends after this. We're not all liars. I know you're not a liar. Also, most of your friends are. But yeah, like, I think that a lot of us spend a lot of time building an image we want to pursue.
Mm-hmm.
And we invest a lot of our personal wealth, like our time, our money, our resources, into achieving or pursuing the image that we think is the kind of image that people will respect. And when we get there, we're like, well, fuck. Why do I still feel empty?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't think anyone has an answer for that, because, I mean, the reality is you haven't achieved what matters to you. So, like, for us, one thing that has really made me happy about working at Softleaf is, like, we spend a lot of time soul searching, man. Like, it's not therapy. It's not that uncomfortable. But at the same time, like, if I feel passionate about something, I can sit down and write about it. And then I can publish it in a venue where, like, a million people get to see it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, hey, like, my musings, welcome to the world.
Yeah.
And that's cathartic, right? I don't know if that's what everyone needs. I mean, I think that some guys out there really do find identity in being a fucking alpha hitter. I'm probably not that guy. It pains me to admit that, but, like, I enjoy the camaraderie of my peers. I do not think that I'm going to ever be the ultimate American warrior. You know, like, I want to build relationships. I want to exert influence. I want to feel like I've made a difference in other people's lives. All of that is important to me. But, you know, like, if I never kill another human being, like, I, okay. You know, like, I don't care.
Yeah.
And I don't think that makes me a weaker person.
No, I don't think so.
I think that we all do well to kind of reflect on what matters to us and then prioritize that in our life, which again goes back to die living, right? Where it's like, you need to figure out what's important to you. And I think that so many of us are unhappy because we spend our entire lives pursuing things that we think will make us happy, whether that be possessions or relationships or experiences. And we don't spend any time identifying what is actually, like, who we are, what we want, and why. Like, I think that Henry David Thoreau is one of the saddest, weirdest human beings on the planet for a variety of reasons. I can't get into his fucking writing. It's fucking... But you know what? That fucking weirdo fucking realized that, like, Walden Pond was his shit, man. Like, he didn't fucking like people. He wanted to go off by himself, and he wanted to muse on why he fucking wanted to be alone. And, like, while I don't understand him, and I am not him, I also respect the fact that he was contemplative enough to identify who he was and what he wanted and to pursue it.
Yeah.
With, you know, with a fervor. Which is funny when you are a boring motherfucker and you pursue boring shit fervently. Like, man, it's crazy how much passion you have about being a loser.
Yeah. Whatever he was looking for, like, he found it. He figured some stuff out.
For himself.
Yes, for himself. But I mean, for think about it though, right? Like, just like you were saying, that cathartic experience where, you know, you figure things out for yourself, and then you go and write about it and you have an audience. And he did the same thing. I mean, you're not Thoreau.
Yeah.
Don't get ahead of yourself. But
no, I'm not Thoreau. No. I wish, like, as much as I think he was a boring piece of shit, I'm like, man, if I was only half as smart as that guy, I would be way happier.
But it's, I mean, it is the same, right? Like, whether you're a best-selling author or you write for a blog, you know, you can take your experiences and write about them, and more than likely, if it has any reach at all, even if it's one or two people, and they can get something from it, then you've impacted someone other than yourself. You've figured things out for yourself, and then you've shared the experience. And I think that's a lot of what society's missing.
I tell guys all the time, like, when people ask about coming into special forces and they're like, well, you know, I have a college degree, I think I should be an officer. And I'm like, well, man, like, I respect what you think is important. I think that you can make the greatest influence on your immediate surroundings by being an NCO. Mm-hmm. Like, you come up from the bottom, you learn a lot through experience, you get to actually keep your hands dirty. And while your sphere may be smaller, the influence that you exert within that sphere is meaningful. Like, you actually build relationships with people. You actually shape other people's perspectives on things through experiential learning.
Yeah.
And I think that you're right, man. Like, I think that if one person reads a blog that I write and they shoot me an email and say, hey, man, I was really going through a hard time and what you wrote kind of reframed the way I saw things. Like, dude, however much time I took to write that, however laborious it was to write my emotions on a fucking, like, you'd be like, I don't really feel like I'm expressing this well. But it's like, dude, I mean, it's not fucking easy to talk about the fact that, like, I'm 37 years old and I'm doing therapy And in therapy, I'm being forced to examine the relationships I have with my parents and stuff. And I'm like, man, this shit sucks, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, it's way easier to just accept that, like, life was tough. I learned some things from it, and I love my parents, as opposed to being like, well, now I have to face what my parents look like with warts, right? You're like, maybe they weren't perfect people. Maybe they had their own issues. And, like, I would rather not think about that. But sure. Talking about it in public is, like, I personally, not just based on my own gut feeling, I've talked with a lot of people who are like, hey, you talking about going to therapy made me reevaluate going to therapy. And like, it's made a huge difference in my life. And I'm like, totally. Wow, thanks, man. Like, I appreciate that. Like, it seemed natural to just throw my bullshit on Front Street. And I did it mainly as a defense mechanism.
Yeah.
Because I feel like if I talk about it, then you can't talk about it.
Yeah.
But also owning it and talking about it, I think makes it easier for other people to be like, yeah, like if that guy's doing it, then I should too, or I can. It doesn't have to feel shitty. And, you know, I mean, I think that's like the first steps in destigmatizing actually being honest about mental health.
Well, and I think that that's where a lot of the whole, I mean, you know, and obviously it's going to go into not just depression, but like, you know, more on the line of post-traumatic stress is, it's coming from within the soft community, because they're the guys who are idolized. And so then it makes the regular guys feel okay about coming forward with it,
which has caused an adverse chain reaction as well. That's terrible.
We're going to come to a really weird place soon too, man, where yeah. like my generation of soft came after what I view to be the lionized generation. So mm-hmm. like, I think that 2001 to 2000 fucking like actually like 97 to 2000 fucking 6 or 2007 yeah. is like the fucking heat of SF. Like, this is the prep for the invasion of Afghanistan, the invasion of Iraq. These are some real fucking heroes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And those are the dudes I look up to. And when I think about my deployments, and I'm like, I mean, if I'm being really objective, yeah, man, I saw a lot of shit. But at the time, I just thought that was like, I thought that was the job. So like, it didn't seem weird to me. And when I talk to my other peers and I hear their stories and I'm like, well, yeah, that's the job. And then I look at it now and I realize we're going back to like a JSET oriented, you know, kind of foreign internal defense. And you could be a fucking SF guy for fucking 20 years and maybe not get in a firefight.
Yeah.
And that's okay, right? I think that the conversation that really needs to happen in all of this is that sometimes when you construct your identity around doing something violent, like when you spend years training to do violence and you don't get to do it, mm-hmm. you feel so cheated and insecure about who you are that you create post-traumatic stress that doesn't fucking exist.
Yeah.
I mean, it does exist for you.
Well, I mean, it does in the definition, like in like the DSM-5, whatever.
Yep.
You know, based on that, like that constant hypervigilance, it's mental blue.
Yeah, I guess I don't mean to denigrate anyone's stress. I guess what I'm really trying to say is that it seems as though the identity conflict that comes with not doing your job creates such a dissonance.
Mm-hmm.
That it is almost more stressful to people to have not experienced combat stress
yeah.
and think that you should than it is to experience it when you think that you should.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, hey, man, I did all these rotations and I didn't fucking see what I thought. I never saw the elephant, as it were.
Yeah.
And now I have to come home and I can either just be forthright with people and be like, yo, man, I did these deployments and I didn't see shit, which that is the easy answer, but it doesn't address all the feelings I have of like inadequacy or, you know, like a conflict of who I am. And especially it would seem in like support roles, you have a lot of guys that create, or guys and gals, service members that create an alternate reality, which is actually stressful for them. Like, they talk about things that never happened to them as though they did.
Yeah.
And small minuscule things become traumatic, which is real. But I think that all of those people could talk through those things if they were going to therapy, man. You know, like,
yeah,
if you could come home and say, I spent 10 years of my life training to do this thing that I never really got to do. Like, you can own that and be done with it.
Yeah.
But I don't think that people... in the 90s, it was one thing because there was no conflict, really. And there was no money. And you can say, like, you know, I nutted up and I joined to serve my country, and the opportunity to go to war never fucking presented itself. And that is what it is. In the 2000s, you nutted up and you joined under the auspices that you were going to get a chance to fight for your country, and it never happened. And how do you justify the fact that there was 20 years of war and you didn't see what people expected you to see? Like, you know, all people know is TV, right?
Yeah. Do you just, yeah, do you just appease them, or?
Yeah. How do you deconflict all that shit, right? Where it's like, it's complicated, man. And I think that we were talking about it. Did you listen to that Sociopathic Tendencies podcast we did with Paul Benaviste?
The first one?
No, the first one was terrible. There's like 20 people on it. It's hard to tell what was happening. We just did one with Worth and
No, I haven't John. Listened to that yet.
It's fucking, it was interesting. We had a the USASOC psych on there, and we were just talking about, like, in general, man, like, if people were required to have a meaningful interaction of talk therapy,
mm-hmm.
you know, I mean, hey man, like, kid, you're in the military, you need to go see a talk therapist 6 times a year. Like, it doesn't just go sit in. It's not weird. Everybody's going to go.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And some guys are just not going to say anything. I get that. And other dudes are going to roll in there and they're going to be like frustrated, and they're not going to, they're just going to fucking word vomit all over this fucking psych. Yep. And the psych's going to be like, hey man, maybe we should set up an appointment next week. And then you can roll into it, right? Like, you never know when somebody's right for talk therapy. You can fucking compartmentalize shit for your entire fucking life. Usually you identify a need for therapy well after the time where you probably should have started going to see a therapist.
Which may be why the DOD should focus on preventative medicine for mental health a little bit more, but...
Preventative medicine in general, right? Like, isn't that crazy?
Yeah. I don't know. What do we know?
Well, we're not fucking doctors, so we can't be credited.
Or PAs. Whatever.
But, I mean, hey, luckily, we got guys like, Jeff Dardia that are going well out of their way to advocate for preventative care for
guys. Was he the bread guy?
He's the Task Force Dagger dude, the one who used to sell Red Bull.
Okay, so I did listen to that one. It was I was talking about you, like, when we talked last, I think I was saying I couldn't listen to the guy who was talking about bread for a podcast.
Oh, that's Dave Delanave.
I couldn't do it.
He just wrote a really cool blog on stress response that I have not published yet, but I'm excited to publish because it is nerdy as fuck.
It was that one was nerdy beyond my level.
But. Yeah, Dave is a character, man. He's one of the most interesting and also infuriating humans I have ever met in
That's
my
what
life.
He said.
Like, yeah, he's a wild man.
Yeah. Shit, man. Yeah, I think, and hopefully we'll see more of that. Hopefully we see. I was talking to one of the, I think I told you, I was talking to the VA doc that I saw a couple weeks ago, and he and I had a really solid conversation. He was a good guy. It was one of those interactions where you're like, I wish you could be the guy that I see all the time.
But guess what? The next time you roll in there, it doesn't matter if you ask for him or not, you're going to get some fucking other dude, right?
Yeah. So, but I mean, the conversation that we had was, you know, we talked a lot about Western culture and, you know, warrior culture and, you know, like from ancient to present and how it differs and how we're failing. And that was the big thing that he said. He's saying the shit that people are, you know, that we're saying in these Facebook threads where, his biggest gripe was that, you know, the whole separation after deployment and not acknowledging what has happened and the mass mental health evaluation post deployment or whenever.
We talk about that in that podcast, man, where it's
it's crazy.
Hey, we have a window to address these things, and yet no one does.
No. I mean, like, why would you? When I got back from my deployment in 2010, we got filtered through, you know, the whole company got pushed through a trailer, you know, like a modular building with two shrinks offices. So a couple hundred dudes going through and hey, did you see this? Did you see this? Well, everybody knows that you're on half days, right? So everybody knows that if no one says shit, then you're all going home right after lunch or before lunch if you get through that fast. So why are you going to say anything? That's not the time, but then when is the time?
I mean, it's one of those things where I'm not sure when it's institutionally mandated there is ever a time that guys are going to be universally receptive to a fucking answer. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I agree.
But I think that if you kind of require people to address it routinely, like, hey, man, you know what? Like, free pass on your sharp class because you're older than 25 and the chances of you raping somebody are pretty fucking low.
Yeah.
We're going to send you over to cycle through the psych's office and you guys are going to get 30 minutes. And like, you can sit and stare at the psych for 30 minutes if you want, or you can just fucking bullshit with the psych. And the psych can be like, hey man, like, you seem like you're pretty well adjusted and things are cool.
Yep.
If you want to come back, here's my card. Or alternately, like, hey, this is a heavy conversation. You want to come back next week? You know what I mean? Like, like, do you want to?
The box is checked.
Like, and if you say, I don't want to come back next week, the psych gets to send a note to your commander that's like, hey, I don't think that I'm the right person for this person, but they don't want to come back next week, and I think they need to talk to somebody, so could you please keep an eye on them?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, or have one of your close friends throw it out there, right?
Yeah.
I don't know what that means, but like, common sense doesn't seem to be that common.
No, I don't think so, especially when within that job set.
Yeah, for sure, man. It's I don't think psychs are fucking insane. I think that, like, in a lot of ways, the way we look at psychiatry is imbalanced. I think that I don't think we know how to address people's things or be there for people when they need us to be there. And I think that we should really be more open-minded to how that progresses.
Yeah. So are you guys kind of circling back to Softlead? Are you guys, you know, you guys are doing the strength training, stamina, mobility, nutrition, like, are you looking to kind of expand into the mental health side at all? I know there's some promotion of like you use Headspace for like guided meditation and stuff like that, which is an awesome, awesome program if anybody hasn't checked it out.
Dude, it is.
Yeah, it's really cool. I really don't like the dude's voice, but they are saying that.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I don't like it. But they're saying there's going to be different options in the next like year or two. So,
Andy's voice is 100% the reason that I use Headspace.
You're weird.
And you know what's even funnier is that I don't say. In a weird, like, I'm going to pretend like I know him. Like, I've actually talked with him. Like, I do know Andy inadvertently. Unlike my relationship with Josh Brolin, which is non-existent, and I still refer to him as Josh.
I'm actually just saying I'm going to start tagging Josh Brolin in everything that we do now. So that eventually...
I love that guy.
Something's got to give, you know?
It's funny. I'm like, I can't send any more Instagram messages to the guy because there'll be like a fucking protective order filed against me.
But like, you know, he's making the posts himself, like, so I mean, he must read some of them.
I started watching
I hadn't seen Deadpool 2, right? And I just, it came on HBO and I was like, oh yeah, we'll watch that. And my wife, we were watching it. My wife was like, oh look, Doug Josh is in this movie. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Oh, Bullet. He's in this, huh? And she's like, she and Amy, Brian's wife, get super annoyed because they're like, you guys talk about Josh like he's your friend. And I'm like, I don't. She's like, you call him his first name. I was like, maybe. A man can dream, all right?
Oh, God.
He's really dreamy. He seems cool. And he seems, unlike other Hollywood actors, I feel like he would actually be the kind of guy who would be fun to hang around.
I think so. Maybe Vince Vaughn, too.
Yeah. I like that. We don't waste a second of our lives thinking about an actress we want to hang out with.
Nope.
But I'm all like, man, that Brolin, he's super cool.
I feel like we'd have a great time together.
Dude, it's I was joking around with Jericho the other day, and I guess Jericho's friends with or associates with Clint Eastwood's son.
Of course he is.
I don't know what his name is because he's not Clint Eastwood, right? But I said something like, Jericho was being grumpy Jericho, and he was all like, you know, all these guys are poser-ass fucking queers. They're not fucking real hitters. They just want to hang out. They want to touch the magic. They want to be around people who are, like, legitimately have lived a life, and they're willing to do whatever to do it. I'm like, oh, shit, are you serious? Man, I should hang out in Hollywood more. And I'm like, also – all of the statements you just made are totally true, except for Clint Eastwood. That guy's fucking legit, right?
Yeah.
And Jericho's like, he's just another fucking faggot movie star. And there was like this 30-second pause where I was sobbing inside. And I didn't say anything because I didn't know what to say. Hey. And Jericho, like, he goes, nah, man, I'm just kidding. He's pretty cool. And I was like, oh, thank you. Like, that's all I needed. I needed you to corroborate that he's okay.
Oh, man. Yeah, we've been missing our connection with him for a bit. We'll have to have him on soon, but I think
with Josh Brolin or Jericho.
I'll ditch Jericho for Josh Brolin any day.
Jericho is a fucking fine figure of a man, and I would murder him to hang out with Josh Brolin.
Yep. I'd do it with you. I'd do that movie you were talking about with the bullet in the head on the ground.
See? Yeah. He's got a pinning move. It's a patented IDF technique.
Oh, man. Well, I think that should, you know, talking about Jericho just trash talking Hollywood should kind of bring us full circle. So, is there anything else you want to hit on before we bounce?
No, man. I am glad that after weeks of trying to schedule this after our kids went to bed, we managed to have a conversation where I was in my garage and you were, you know, wandering your house in your underwear.
Something like that. Letting my dog out, trying to figure out if my dog's eating shit in the backyard.
They are always eating shit in the backyard.
Yeah. No, I don't even know why I wonder anymore. Whatever. Well.
Well, hey, man, I've got a shooting match to attend in the morning where I will inevitably embarrass myself greatly. Absolutely. And that's okay.
Yeah. You keep being mediocre, buddy.
Yeah, dude. I mean, a high watermark, like high center mass is okay, right?
Sure.
Yeah. We don't need a really good heartbeat. We just need that center mass.
Yeah. Well, that's what 9 mil's for, right?
Yeah. Oh, dude. Well, like that's why you have capacity. That's why I carry a 54 round magazine. Like people made a joke. But my pistol caliber carbine, legitimately, I laid my guns out where we were talking, and I have one of these MBX Mega Mags, or actually I got it's an MBX Mini, and I have 47 rounds in the magazine, and Like, you don't have to reload on stages, you know? Like, you can make a lot of mistakes and still put a dude down.
God, it looks like fun.
Yep. I love, like, my warrant's like, I can't believe you're advocating loose, sloppy shooting. And I'm like, look, sir.
Yeah,
just put it down. You only refer to warrants. You only refer to warrants as sir in a cavalier manner, I might add. You're like, look, sometimes a 75% solution is good enough. They don't have to all be fives. I want alphas and Charlies, and I want to win. Like, and if I can put three Charlies in a dude faster than one alpha, I'm going to fucking take that every day of the week.
Amen.
I'm not trying to rescue Captain Phillips. I'm not a Navy SEAL. I will take a mediocre solution all day long. That's a quotable.
That is a quotable. I'll probably actually put that in the podcast description.
Nice.
Yeah.
Not trying to rescue Captain Phillips.
and it has nothing to do with the majority of what we talked about, so it'll be perfect.
Right on, man. Well, cool, man. I appreciate you guys having me on, and I'll look forward to next time we wrap.
Yeah, brother, absolutely. We'll have to do it soon.
Awesome, man. I'll holler at you a little later.
All right. Take care, man.
All right, you too. Bye. Bye.
I think the biggest misperception is that somehow we're damning. But nothing really can stop us.